Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by ELEC 825. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM and 97.5 HG2, part of the Beasley Media Group. Ready to help you move into the weekend, talking about all the news in the world of sports. I hope you watched Thursday Night Football last night.
So, the answer again is no,
I did not. You missed it.
But here's the thing. I did wake up in the middle of the night and check, because as you know, I have fantasy, a loser fantasy team.
Do you have Jamar Chase?
And Chase Brown.
Oh, so you had a very good night. You didn't care that the Bengals
lost. I woke up to Thursday Night Football was over and I have 78 points.
Yeah, you don't need to watch
and,
like,
and
the
rest of the weekend.
I guarantee
you I'll still lose.
I was going to say, are you still going to have 78 points at the end of the weekend? Or
I lost last week because I went out to brunch and forgot to look to see if Brian Robinson Jr. was playing.
We should go back to the evolution of this show like 5-6 years ago when you were just giving me a hard time about talking about my fantasy team on the radio. And here I'm trying to talk about a good football game that was a shootout.
Quarterbacks with a controversial ending.
The quarterbacks combined for 718 passing yards, 8 touchdowns, 0 interceptions. Jamar Chase had his night, and all you care about is your fantasy team.
No, what I care about is you keep talking about all these amazing offensive numbers.
Yes.
How about the fact that the Ravens, which were always known for defense,
their passing defense
are
brutal.
putrid on defense.
They are awful in their secondary. So
I don't care how good those two quarterbacks are. Those two teams are not going to the Super Bowl. If you look at the number of points per game that the Bengals are giving up, like, if you're Joe Burrow, you just got to be throwing up your hands. Like, what else can I do?
Yeah, I don't know that Joe Burrow could have done anything else other than put on a ref jersey and throw a flag on the penalties at the end of the game.
No, I'm talking about defense. I mean, the pressure is on for him and Lamar Jackson to score every single time they have the ball. And somehow, at least last night, they did it because they had equally bad defenses on the other side.
Yes.
But I hate to tell you, when the Bengals and the Ravens play the Chiefs, that's not happening. And it's not because the Chiefs are undefeated. It's the Chiefs' defense is great this year.
They are very good. And I will say, how the NFL let DeAndre Hopkins go to play with Patrick Mahomes is stunning.
DeAndre Hopkins seemed like he was done when he was on the Titans.
Well, he looked like he took some of the fountain of youth before he played the game last week.
Yeah.
So I do want to talk to you, though. You know, it's funny. I normally bitch about the refs when the Eagles play, and you don't want to hear it because.
Correct.
You don't. But so.
But you're going to talk anyway.
But I had no, like, stake in the game last night. Like, they call everything in this league. How do you miss some of these blatant face masks that decide games?
I don't know. And those are the kind of things that cause injuries. So, and those are the things that should be most visible. You can get away with holding. You can be very artful or deceptive about holding. You can't get away with a face mask without somebody seeing that.
Or clubbing somebody in the head. Like, yeah, the point of emphasis is the quarterback. That's what they, and you're the lawyer. There's a lot of people betting a lot of money on these games.
What does being a lawyer have to do with a football game?
Because tell me somebody's not going to try and file a lawsuit over this
about
at some
what?
Point.
Over a ref's call?
If it costs a lot of people money in a game.
Okay, somebody disbar whatever lawyer files a lawsuit because a ref calls a bad call.
All right.
Come on.
Say something on the radio that you will not want to live up to afterwards now.
I can assure you I won't be the person filing that lawsuit if that's what you're suggesting.
I don't think you
will. Not happening.
I just think that, you know, to keep ignoring this and not acknowledge that weekly now, there are big plays in big games that partially decide games. I'm not saying that there aren't opportunities throughout the game, but this is not a mom-and-pop league. This is a gazillion-dollar industry. They have got to get this better.
Gazillion. Is that an actual number?
How much is it?
How many zeros are in a gazillion?
How much is the NFL worth?
I mean, is a gazillion more than what the Russians fine Google? Which I can't even say that number.
So the average NFL franchise is worth $6.49 billion.
which I believe is less than a gazillion.
It is, but they would add up, and then the league would have value, and I can't count anyway, so what's the difference?
I just want to know how many zeros are in a gazillion.
You just want to ask me questions I don't plan for on the radio. Why don't we go to a little more serious conversation, and then we'll keep the fun talk going afterwards, okay?
Sounds good to me.
All right. Let's bring on ESPN investigative reporter TJ Quinn. We could talk to you about the deep investigations that you do, and we'll get to some of that. But the real reason we're having you on is talk about Pedro Gomez and the legacy of Pedro and Pedro Palooza event. We've talked to you about him before. Talk to us about the idea of what you guys are all doing this year with Pedro Palooza.
Yeah, the foundation was something that Pedro's wife, Sandy, put together after he died. Anybody in this business, anybody who knows baseball particularly, knew Pedro. And, you know, I think Keith Olbermann said, you know, right after he died that Pedro was everybody's best friend. He was, I mean, the relationships you had with him, he was one of my closest friends. And everybody was looking for something to do after his death. Like, you can't just say goodbye to somebody like that who had such a presence in people's lives. And so we thought about what are the issues that he really cared about. And through the foundation, you know, it's only been really 3 years of this work, but we set up scholarships with the University of Arizona, with Arizona State. We set up an internship in partnership with the Arizona Republic and the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Kind of amazed at how quickly we were able to do that and raise some money. And it was centered around this annual event, Pedro Palooza, that just his name just lent itself to it. And we recognized, particularly, you know, Sandy recognized that you can't just drag this out forever. People lose interest, they lose momentum, a lot of things competing for people's charitable dollars and their time. And it's also a lot of work to put together events like this. And we thought, let's go out big. Let's do one last real event. And we've been able to make some goals. Those scholarships have been endowed, which is great. We've raised, you know, we're going to be able to do those internships, fully paid summer internship. We're going to be able to continue doing that for a while. But it's also just one more way to get all these people together who loved that man. I mean, I miss him every day. I don't think I talk to anybody in my life as often as I spoke to him.
You know, you mentioned the scholarships. To me, the important thing about the scholarship, it's about what he loves. It's not just a general scholarship, from my understanding. This is about carrying on the legacy that he had, which is reporting.
It was. I mean, the one is at Arizona State is with the Cronkite School, where he frequently spoke to students. The one at the University of Arizona is actually for baseball players, which was special because his son, Rio, who was in the Red Sox system, pitched professionally and unbelievably in Taiwan this past season, was, you know, played at the University of Arizona. Yeah, those were crucial to him. And that was a big part of this internship as well. It's for a bilingual young journalist, because that was a big thing with Pedro when he would speak to students, which he did all the time. If you are bilingual, that is an incredible tool. You're able to bridge communities. You're able to tell stories in places other people can't. Embrace that. And so that's a big part of what we're trying to pass on.
It wasn't just his relationship with friends like you. It was his relationship with people he didn't know at all. I mean, Jeff and I met him 5-6 years ago when we were covering spring training. We hadn't met him before. We hadn't interviewed him on the show before. We just kind of asked him, and all of a sudden he's coming on, and the next thing you know, he's kind of regularly talking to us about stuff. And so it was the way he treated the people who could really do nothing for him. Like, who were we? We had a radio show. And he was this guy who had reported these huge stories, and yet he gave us as much time as he did anybody else.
He absolutely did that. And to go through a public place with him was always incredible, the connection people would have. And even, you know, to be in a clubhouse, look, there are some people in a major league clubhouse or some other sport locker room. You walk in as a journalist and Sometimes you're too friendly, which is not good, and sometimes you're too adversarial, which is too good, which is not good. And Pedro was able to draw that line where he could just always connect to you as a person. He would find something about you to connect with, but it didn't keep him from doing his job. You know, one of the most amazing things I ever saw in my life, and I feel like we talked about this before, was, you know, he ripped Curt Schilling the night before Game 7, 2001, in the World Series, saying this guy has been, you know, a me first guy his whole career. He has been a terrible teammate, but here's his chance to redeem himself. It wasn't just gratuitously going after somebody. It was holding the most important player on that team accountable on that day in a way that was thoughtful and intelligent and one of the bravest things I've ever seen, because the fan base did not want to hear that the day before they're about to win their first World Series. And I was with him, you know, the night before he wrote that column, which was fantastic. Sandy, his wife, a good friend of ours, Steve Kevin, and I were on the phone with him, like, just, hey, if you feel like this is what you want to do, do it, but just understand, you know, make sure you're really aware of what you're walking into here. And the next day, you know, we get to the ballpark in Phoenix and I say, how you doing? And he plays some of the voicemail messages people had left for him, which was the most racist, nasty stuff you've ever heard. And what does he say? I need to go down there to the field, don't I? And get, which, yeah, he knew the answer to his own question. He knew he had to be accountable. And we knew walking through that stadium, anybody could take a shot at him. Anybody could say something, throw a punch, throw a beer, whatever. I mean, I've seen fans do some pretty nasty things. We get down to the field and we just walked around in foul territory just so if anybody had something to say, he was there to hear it. And what happens? Greg Swindell was pitching with the Diamondbacks at the time, is walking off the field, sees Pedro, changes direction, walks over, shakes his hand, gives this huge nod, and then walks away back into the dugout. And it was the sign that the guys in the clubhouse knew what he was about, that he was speaking up for the guys who were furious with Schilling. You know, there was such perfect Pedro to me that it was, yeah, he wanted you to like him. He was not someone who had thick skin. He wasn't somebody who, you know, some people just are fearless. He wasn't. He wrote it because it was his job and he knew it was the right thing to do. And did it in the right way and made himself accountable. And the players knew that and respected it. And, you know, it's just there are very few people like him.
But isn't that what made him special? What isn't that what makes most good sports journalists special is the ability to connect with the athletes that you have to cover, but to also know that there is a line that you can't cross. I mean, we've heard the story that you just mentioned, but even covering Barry Bonds, he went through a struggle doing that.
He got hammered for it. I was with him places, you know, we'd be on the field in San Francisco because I was following all that too. And I mean, we were friends since 1996 when he was covering the A's and I was covering the White Sox. And you just kind of recognized, wow, I like this guy. And, you know, anytime we were together, we were hanging out and I heard the stuff people yelled at him. I heard the stuff Barry yelled at him. I was with him start of spring training. What was it? 2007 maybe, or probably earlier. I don't know. But, when Barry walked in and has to do this huge press conference, and the first thing he does is look at Pedro and says, "You still lying, Gomez?" You know, in front of everybody, and Pedro's got to stand there and take it. But it was also never personal with Pedro. It wasn't, "I'm going to get this guy." He was offended by the idea that a player was doping, and you know, I think he really felt that personally. But he could. That was the thing that got me. And I think that's what you were just talking about was but he always remembered he was a human being, you were a human being, and that you could do your job and not forget that.
How do you handle that? You personally, how did Pedro handle it? How does a journalist handle an athlete yelling at them, an athlete coming after them? The reason I ask is we're now dealing in Philadelphia with a reporter who maybe crossed a line in what he wrote about Joel Embiid, but Joel Embiid then crossed a line by going after him and laying his hands on him. How, as a sports journalist, do you deal with those situations and not make yourself part of the story?
Oh man, it's a constant, struggle, reevaluation, whatever. It's funny, when I got to ESPN, one of my bosses, Dwayne Bray, had just finished being interviewed by some publication. He said, "Let me ask you something. You've been interviewed before, right?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Has anyone ever quoted you accurately?" I said, "Not yet." And he said, "Yeah, me either." And that we talked about how every journalist should go through that, what it's like to be on the other side, that you have to remember, with the stories that we write about, particularly, the stuff I do is investigative, right? No one ever likes hearing from me, frankly. I'm not the one who calls for the good news. I
Should we
try
keep
to.
that in mind if you call us out of the blue?
Something's
And I
wrong.
was no, that'll only be for good
Oh
reason.
crap, PJ's calling.
It was funny. I was on the. I was. I got pulled into division series coverage just as a sideline guy, like in 2008 or 9 or whatever. And I was doing. It was Orioles Tigers, and I'm there again just to be the sideline guy. And Dan Duquette was the GM of the Orioles at the time and sees me, and he walked up and said, "Is there anything I need to know?" And I said, "No, it's all good. I'm just doing baseball. There's no."
He saw you and he was a little worried
He was like, he's
that
like, "Oh God, what
you were there.
happened?" I mean, I really do try to remember, like, one, it's not personal. I don't go after people to get them. You go after a story and you try to tell it accurately, and you try to think about what it would be like to be on the other side of that, and how would I want to be treated. And not everybody does that. Some people are too deferential, and some people are too, I think, I would say insensitive. Even jerks have rights. Even people who do things wrong, you don't have to demonize them. And I've had people say to me years later that they felt like, they may not have liked what I reported, but they never took it personally. Some do, some don't, but you just be honest. Don't try to fool anybody. Don't try to trick anybody. Do your job. Be obvious about what you're doing, or transparent about what you're doing. Look, it's tough. I mean, like you mentioned, if a guy like Joel Embiid gets mad at you, there's not a whole lot you can do, right? I mean, the closest I ever came to any kind of scrape with somebody in a clubhouse was with a shortstop. And even that was like, oh man, I don't know how well I'm going to survive this. Nothing happened, but it's like, this is the smallest guy on the team, and he's still a professional athlete. You are vulnerable in that sense, and there's never any reason to put your hands on somebody, and that's absolutely wrong. And it's kind of a risk that you take, but you gotta, if you're going to do this job the right way, if you're going to report, you better be accountable. You better be out there, and you better be able to go to those people. Some of them get it, some of them don't. One of the best I ever had when I covered Tony Phillips with the White Sox, was one of my favorite guys I ever covered. He got in a fight with a fan in Milwaukee. Part of my job at the time was writing a column about it. I ripped him, and I went up to him in the clubhouse and I said, "Hey, look, I don't know if you'll see this or not, but I wrote it. I ripped you. If you have anything to say, I'll be here." And he said, "Kid, I got it coming. Give it to me." And it was a great lesson for me, like, be straightforward. But that also happened with a certain Mets player where I was critical. And then same thing, I told him, when I was covering that team, I said, "Look, this is the point I made. I don't know if you're going to see it, but I don't want to hide from you." And he said, "Wow, that's really stand up. I have respect for that." And then he screwed me for the next 18 months, every chance he could get. Finally, I was like, "Dude, enough." He's like, "All right, okay."
I'm curious though, how far do you go in reporting? I mean, you tackle, especially as an investigative reporter, some really difficult and challenging issues. I've seen you mention in other interviews a book about by Robert Caro on writing, where it looks at the process of it. I'm sure you never feel like you have enough, but how far do you go in terms of interviewing people and pushing to get that story and choosing what you include and don't? Because part of the Embiid situation is Jeff and I kind of feel like the reporter could have written the story without the part that inflamed Embiid with his family in there. So how do you make those decisions as a reporter?
Well, even that reporter said he felt like, after the feedback that he got on, I assume it was social media and however else people reached out, that express some regret from what I saw. Look, it helps to have editors and people to talk through it with, and because you may have an idea that this doesn't seem personal or it's well in bounds, and somebody may point out, well, not really. That's part of it. I mean, you bring up Robert Caro, who I think is, the absolute gold standard as a journalist and as an historian. I mean, the guy's written four books, five books so far, and we're all waiting for the fifth. And they are, four volumes on the life of Lyndon Johnson. The first volume was published in 1981, and we're still waiting for the last one. I can't do what Robert Caro does, where I take Lyndon Johnson's brother and I take him to the family home, which is a national landmark, and sit him down at the family dinner table at dinner time, and then sit behind him to get him to describe what he's seeing, and have him suddenly break down decades of myths about who Lyndon Johnson was and what his upbringing was, right? I don't have the time or the resources, and maybe I don't even have the, I don't know, the guts to do that, the depth of the kind of reporting that he does. But you never feel like you're finished. It's funny, like when you say investigative journalism or you describe yourself as an investigative reporter, people, even in the business, sometimes think it's like there's this sort of mystical side to what we do. There's something, it's like this, like somehow we're national intelligence, we've got the secret training or whatever. Mostly what we have is more time, just to really, really dig on something. Every story, you just, have you answered every question? And you never get totally to the end of it. But like, the largest, the most recent really big project I worked on was a breakdown of the 10 months that Brittany Griner spent in a jail in Russia. And when we started out, we thought, this is going to be maybe 4,000 or 5,000 word piece, which is a very long piece. And we'll talk to the State Department and the White House and people around her. But then you kept thinking, well, all right, who else is out there that we can talk to? And what about the guy they traded her for, Victor Boot, the merchant, so-called merchant of death? What if there's a way to get him? And we reached out and we got him. I mean, it was all of a sudden I'm on a Zoom call with him from Moscow and spent 5 hours on the phone with that guy. And not at one time, but over the course, we did an 80 something minute Zoom call that we recorded and did a piece out of, but altogether, like the question, and I'm thinking of Robert Caro every time I'm reaching out to him, he was willing to let me keep asking, what did your jail cell look like? What color was the paint? Where did the light come from? Where did the light come from the window? What sound did the guards' shoes make when they came down the hall? Did their keys rattle? Paint this picture for me. There's always something more. And then we thought, what about the judge who sentenced him to prison in the United States? We reached out to her. She got back to us. And all these people, just kept, if you decide at the beginning, this person's not likely to talk to us, we're not likely to get this information, you're never going to get it. And I could have gone on another 2 years probably trying to tell more and more of that story. But at some point, it's like there's only so much information you can get. We got things we never expected. We got people, access to people from the White House and the State Department that we never expected. We got access to people in Russia we never expected. You just kind of keep pulling on all those threads, and at some point, it's always a judgment call. Is this enough to go with? Have I told a complete story? And
So how do you know when to stop pulling the thread? I mean, the work that you did on the Brittany Griner story was so important, and getting it out is important. But at the same time, as you said, you're getting to talk to Victor Boot, and you're getting to talk to judges, things you don't think that you're going to be able to accomplish as part of a story. And as you peel that onion, when do you say, look, I still have left pieces of the onion, but I have to stop here. This is where I have to tell the story.
Well, part of it, sometimes an editor makes that decision for you and just says, enough already, And in this case, what I thought was going to be a 4,000 or 5,000 word piece ended up a 20,000 word piece. It's half a book. It's the longest thing I've ever written. Maybe it was too long. I don't know. But it really is just, it's sort of a judgment thing. Have I told a complete story? I like this. The thing I preach all the time is that I really think journalism should be treated as science, that you can go into it with an hypothesis, but do everything you can to disprove it. Don't go in with an idea, this is what I think the story is, and then confirmation bias is just going to let you support that hypothesis, and you're going to be bringing in information for a preconceived notion. You have to be willing to break down every conception you have about a story. And one of those in this case would have been, who is Victor Boot, right? Another one was about her treatment in prison. There was no good experience in a Russian prison, right? But there were all these concerns that people had about what is her treatment going to be? One, as an American; two, as a Black American; three, as a gay Black American; four, as a gay Black American woman. And so, yeah, we had to ask what was the reality of that. And the fact was, it could have been a hell of a lot worse than it was. And sometimes that doesn't, people may not want to read that, because it may sound like you're almost excusing it, or sounding like it's not as bad as it was. No, not saying that at all. I'm just saying you got to tell an accurate picture. And did we do everything we could to paint a picture of what her life was like in there day to day, without access to her, by the way, because she published her own memoir. She fortunately, through people, didn't tell anybody not to talk to me, which was great. And I was able to finally meet her back in May. And
What was that like to
to
finally
meet
get to,
her?
yeah, to get to meet her after telling her story and trying to fight for her?
That was really something. It was funny. She came over to I don't know. I mean, she would have no reason to know who I was, right? It's because she doesn't know what's being published in the US. What's funny is Victor Boot knew who I was, because we get on this first phone call and I said, I'm surprised you wanted to do this. And he said, well, your coverage was fair. I said, you were able to follow it? He said, all we watch in prison is ESPN. So he's seeing every report I'm doing on SportsCenter and NBA Today. Brittany has no idea who I am. She's just been told, this is a guy who is covering you for ESPN and probably, did more of it than other people. So she came, she's got to bend down 2 feet to hug me, which is, you don't typically hug sources, but she just came right over. And it was really funny, because it's this totally one-sided kind of thing where, look, I did my job. I was never someone who's like, we are BG. No, that's not my job. I may have personal feelings where I think she should be out of there, but my job is to report. I'm not an advocate. There are other people to do that. I've got to be clear-headed about my job and do that all the time. But that doesn't mean that I wasn't invested in her story. And it doesn't mean that when I met her, I was a little emotional, like, wow, here's this person that, I know all this stuff about, and she knows like nothing about me. But she was, could not have been nicer. Could not. I mean, there's something fascinating about her. Anybody who's been around her, she is captivating. There's just something about her personality that just really, you get drawn in. And even prison guards, over there was this great story. I talked to one of her teammates over there, Zhenya Belyakova, who went to visit her when she was in jail in Moscow. And she walks in, they said, who are you here to visit? And she said, Brittany Griner. And the guards say, oh, you're here to see our girl. And she's like, your girl? She's my girl. What are you talking about? So it was kind of cool to see that in person. The only interaction I'd ever had with her before, when I think she was about to graduate from Baylor and was at ESPN, she bumped into me at the Starbucks line, apologized. I said, that's cool. And that was the extent of our relationship.
Before we let you go, I wanted to ask about you've written a bit this year a lot about gambling in sports also, whether it was the Shohei stories
Oh, man, yeah.
or the other stories with David Fletcher and the Angels out there. So you've seen some of the impact of gambling on sports. Jeff and I have talked a lot about it on the show. It's not something that's just relegated to baseball or even professional sports, as we see a lot of college sports having these issues. As somebody who's watched it up close with some of these stories, can you talk about the threats you see to the sports and the integrity of those games?
The threats are enormous, and we're only barely starting to see them. I mean, with Ohtani, I mean, it was because the person involved was so outsized and the story was so weird. I mean, at first, everyone's reaction is, how could he not know? How is Ohtani not the one actually
That
betting? I think that's
was our reaction. How do you not
yeah, that
know
was
about your
and I
bank
think the
account?
same with ours. And that's why, and thank God, it's like, it's why you don't go into it with this idea that he must have been betting the whole time. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. Let's find out what we can. And at the end, the story made sense, the way it did. But There are going to be players. There are certainly players who have done that. And from what I know about the nature of gambling, before it was legalized the way it was in the US, it's the lower levels that are really vulnerable. It's, in tennis, you saw that with, lower ranked players, these matches nobody's keeping an eye on. But all of a sudden, these betting markets all over the world, typically in Asia, you have that with lower division soccer teams, where people are making these bets in foreign markets on sports in other countries that are below the radar. They're not looking at Manchester United or Chelsea, any team like that. It's these lower division things, and they can start to clean up. And it's the same vulnerability here. And I've also seen, my son played junior college baseball for 2 years and was talking about teammates he had who all of a sudden were completely over their heads with legal gambling. These are junior college students. We don't know how to deal with it, frankly. It's going to be, this is going to be, we could have multiple people do nothing but this, for years to come.
We really appreciate your time, but before we let you go, we want to just one more time just have you talk about Pedro Palooza, how people can get involved, and just your last thoughts on Pedro.
Yeah, that's oh man, and I really appreciate your asking about it. So the event, which is open to the public, this is if you're in Phoenix, you want to go to Phoenix. It's just going to be a week from Friday, the 14th and 15th. There's a gala, Pedro Palooza, a terrific local club, the Deuce, and then the next day there's a golf event that actually is even more popular than that. We've got this huge auction, some amazing events. Speaking of golf, because it's a big golf crowd, we've got you can bid on a round of golf at Wingfoot for three people with dinner and drinks.
Jeff,
Most
you're going
people
to
don't
bid on
get
that
that.
for me, right?
That's
Of course.
a pretty
I'm
good
not
one.
taking you, but I'll
I was
bid
going to
on
say you're going to bid. You're just not going to
it.
bring me. I see how it
Get him a cocktail napkin or something
That's right.
is
I'll give him a golf
during the
ball.
event.
Come
Get
on,
him
DJ. I
right.
thought you were on my side here.
It's I'm on no
You're a
one's side.
reporter. You take no side. I understand
Exactly. But
that.
it's not personal. That's the
No,
whole
it's not
point of it.
personal.
But we're gonna have, it's anyone in the public can bid on these. You can go to the, just look up Pedro Gomez Foundation. That's the organization has a website. We're putting those items all up there. There are terrific sports packages, tons of memorabilia. So, you can come and have fun, but you can also participate by bidding on those items, which are, again, fantastic, by just making direct donations. And I just, for all of us, it's a way to hang on to this dear friend, the kind who, when his son, was draft his son Rio was drafted and was playing rookie ball, and he came to town with the Lowell Spinners to play the Brooklyn Cyclones, and Pedro flew in, and I picked him up at the airport. Came to my house and he grabs my son, who's 13 at the time, and says, "Mikey, let's go. Grab a bat, grab the tee. We're going to the backyard to look at your swing." And when he died, all three of my kids just absolutely devastated, because he didn't just get involved in your life; he was involved in everybody in your life. And if we get another chance to celebrate that and what he brought, God, that's worth everything.
Well, whether there's Pedro Palooza or not, we will always take the chance to talk Pedro Gomez with you. We appreciate you giving some other thoughts while you're with us. And thanks for always giving us a little time to talk through everything. We'll make sure to put out the website link to the Pedro Gomez Foundation so that people can look if they want to bid on things or sign up. And I wish you the best of luck with it.
Huge. Thank you guys so much. Really appreciate it.
I'm really glad that TJ gives us the time to talk about Pedro. I mean, we talk about lots of other stuff with him, and we'll get into some of that soon. But I said it in the interview, he had no reason to befriend us the way he did at spring training, and yet he did. And I always appreciated that, and I'm glad that we can help continue his legacy on this show.
It also amazed me how much of baseball he covered. There was nothing that was, there are a lot of reporters, once they get to a certain level, something is beneath them.
Nothing is
Pedro
beneath them.
always wanted to go where the story is. And it was always amazing to me that how much he had a passion for everything in baseball, much like we do, but obviously not the same level of passion. to the point that he loved minor league baseball, partly because his own son was going to be playing in it. But, you know, one of the other places we saw him was at a double A All-Star game in Trenton, New Jersey.
That's right. That was the game that Tebow played in, right?
That's right. Yeah. And so he was wherever baseball was growing, wherever there was a baseball story to tell.
And he was a storyteller. He was a baseball historian. Like, he knew baseball, but he could tell and explain baseball to the average person in a way that you got it.
Yeah. And he told us, he was revered in a way. I mean, he would walk around and you would see how much admiration players had for him and coaches had for him and people in front offices had for him. But there was also, I wouldn't call it a fear, but there was, hey, you better watch it. The people would be as honest as possible with him, but they knew that he was also a serious journalist and he was going to tell a serious story. That's why when you hear these stories, I can't hear them enough about, you know, what happened when with the Barry Bonds story and other things that he went through, and hearing them from TJ is just so important.
We did ask TJ a lot of questions about, you know, investigative reporting, and one of them kind of hit local with Joel Embiid.
Although it doesn't, the problem with the Joel Embiid story is now that we're going to get onto this is there hasn't been a lot of hard hitting journalism necessary because Joel Embiid just keeps saying stupid things, and then the team keeps saying stupid things. Like, the hard hitting journalism is, what is his real injury? Because as we sit here now, do you know what it is?
No.
Okay. So that would be the hard hitting journalism. The thing that is out in the open, unlike what Kawhi Leonard used to do and what other players used to do, is, you know, there was at least some idea of what the injury is, but you questioned how serious it was and whether or not there was a need for days off. The Sixers just, you know, Joel Embiid said, I'm not playing back-to-back days the rest of my career. And then for some reason, the Sixers have just had him out. I mean, we were half joking before the season started when we talked to Keith Pompey about the fact that, you know, he said there was a scheduled doctor's visit. And my question was, well, when was it scheduled?
When was it scheduled? Yeah.
Right. And we half joked about whether he was going to play in the preseason, where we're told that he was going to play in one game. He didn't even do that. And now, by the time Joel Embiid plays in a game after his three-game suspension, 10% of the season will be over.
Yes.
Over 10% of the season will be over, and the Sixers will likely only have one win.
Yes.
And
well, I don't know if they'll likely.
You have Paul George, who's trying to round back into shape. You'll have Joel Embiid. He will be clearly out of shape. Okay. If you don't play in games, it doesn't matter what you do on a bicycle. It doesn't matter what you do running. He'll be out of shape. And Tyrese Maxey will not be playing.
Can we separate this into two parts, though? Can we talk about the Embiid situation first with the locker room, and then talk about the state of the Sixers? Because I think they deserve separate conversations. Now, I am very confused, okay? Marcus Hayes wrote his column at the time. You and I both had thoughts about how we didn't really think that it was appropriate, the things that were being put in there. Not that you can't call Joel Embiid out for playing or not playing, but equating that to family, his son, his dead brother. There was no
reason for Marcus to put in a story about whether Joel Embiid was playing hard or not, or was playing at all or not, anything about a past relative. It just isn't necessary.
And I think, as TJ has said, I think Marcus has kind of acknowledged that a little bit to some people. So that's lane one. It's kind of three lanes here. Lane two is Embiid and the player. And
right.
You were very frustrated before the incident on Saturday, last Friday, when he did his press conference dropping F-bombs about everything he's done for the city.
No. I can't say the word he said before the city, at least for the live broadcast.
Yes.
It's the that's what I have a problem with.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a problem with him saying how much he's done. I have a real problem with him saying how much he's done for the bleeping city.
I think that there's a little bit of, I think it's tied back to the family. I think he looks at himself as leaving his family to come chase his dream and not being able to see his brother. I think it comes across as you don't appreciate me for what I've done playing basketball on the court. So I think there's two different conversations on there.
No. There are lots of times I just disagree with you. This one is beyond a disagreement.
Go ahead.
I am not going to, nor should anybody in the city, nor should the city itself, accept the fact that the reason he said it is because he left his family behind.
I don't accept
to make
it.
Make hundreds of millions of dollars.
I don't accept it. I still think he's wrong for saying it, but I think the context in all of this conversation
That's not the context.
Matters.
The context is he was angry.
Yes.
It stems from him being angry that everybody does not kiss his bleep. That's it.
So that's what it is. You don't think
Embiid has accomplished nothing. Okay? He is very good at his craft. He is very talented.
That's not true that he hasn't accomplished anything.
What did he win at Kansas?
He has not.
What did he win at Kansas?
Titles. He's
that's
won
right.
awards.
So what has he accomplished?
Well, he's won awards and he's done a lot of things. He hasn't won you the title you want. When you say he hasn't accomplished anything, it's like not true. He hasn't won what we want. They haven't advanced past the second round.
Okay, well,
they
haven't I'll go down to the local trophy store in Philadelphia and see if I can get some second
round. He's got lots of legitimate trophies from the league, none of which are the team trophy we want.
That's all that matters.
But to you, to me.
That's all. Okay, that's all that matters to a city. I have never seen. This city has supported him and chanted MVP for seasons.
I agree with you on all these things. Like you, I don't want to be out that I'm disagreeing with you. I think he's in the wrong.
Yeah, but you're bending over backwards to find explanations where sometimes there's no explanation. Here's the deal. Black and white, Marcus Hayes was wrong. He should not have brought up his brother. Black and white, Joel Embiid is wrong to call it this effing city. And come up with any frustration about the city. There is absolutely nothing that this city has done, nor its fans in this particular case. There are lots of times that we can sit there and say the fans were difficult on X. Okay. There has never been a time that this city has booed Joel Embiid to the point that he deserved it. And right now the city is just frustrated. Because Joel Embiid started this by often coming into camp out of shape and this year telling everyone that he wasn't playing a lot of games. And since he has said that, he has played zero games. And since he has said that, nobody knows honestly what's going on.
And whose fault is that?
Joel Embiid.
And
the Sixers organization. I'll tell you who it's not the fault of.
Marcus
Nick
Hayes
Nurse.
And Nick
no,
Nurse.
Nick Hurt, Nick Nurse, yes. Who is just a victim in all of this.
Well, and that's okay. So, though, but there's another
Daryl Morey.
Joel
Embiid
was also wrong for physically confronting Marcus Hayes. You can't do that.
There is no excuse for laying your hands.
No matter what you feel, you cannot do that. Jeff, you were at work today. You cannot touch somebody at work, a customer, a coworker. You cannot put hands on them. He was at work in the locker room. You can't do that. Now, where the hell were the Sixers? And where have they been all along? They haven't been honest with the fans. They're hanging their coach and player out to dry. How do you let him in the locker room without making them talk separately beforehand to resolve the issue when you know how angry Embiid was the day before? How do the Sixers do that? How do they not facilitate?
Again, he's an adult.
But they knew that Marcus
is an adult.
He is. But they are the team. They knew that Marcus Hayes would be there. They knew Embiid would be there. They try to pull them aside. You got to try to do that. You can't subject everybody else to this unsafe situation there, which could have gotten much worse. We're lucky it stopped where it did.
I don't know what to tell you. There usually there is not clear blame when you talk to people. In this particular case, there's clear blame, and that clear blame falls one on Joel Embiid. And if he is really hurt, that's okay. Then come out and say what's really going on. He hasn't. And then the second level of blame goes to Daryl Morey, because Daryl Morey is often not front and center for a general manager to be saying what's going on and to take control, because the buck is supposed to stop in part with him. And third, the owner, who's spending his time watching Commanders games now.
So the snarky, I like to have fun with everything. Do you find it ironic that after screaming at the Sixers to get Embiid on the court, they gave him a suspension to not put him on the court? Like, if they really wanted to punish the Sixers, wouldn't they say you have to be out
there? How do you know where it starts, though? That's the interesting
part. Well, now all of a sudden he was ready to play. He was going to show up the other day. So magically, yeah, he'll be ready after the suspension. I don't think so.
Was he really ready to play, or is it, let's get the clock started on the suspension?
Yes. So that, guess what game he comes back for? The first game against the Knicks for that play-in tournament, the in-season tournament, magically.
What I would have, if I were the NBA, what I would have done is I would have said the suspension doesn't start till Joel Embiid plays a game more than 20 minutes. And then once he plays a game more than 20 minutes, the next game, the suspension starts.
They might have gone through the whole season at that point.
Yeah, you might have.
I mean, look,
but that's the way. And by the way, did you hear the story about Daryl Morey with the Rockets?
Which one?
The one where he apparently, after they lost a game in Houston, went to the owner and said that they actually won.
I don't want to hear that story. No.
So apparently.
So the fact that the Sixers are 1-6 to start, they're really 6-1.
So Tillman Fertitta apparently wanted Daryl Morey out of Houston because they literally lost. They lost a playoff game. Or a series, and then Daryl Morey, this has apparently been reported by somebody we're not a big fan of, but apparently Daryl Morey then walked up to Tillman Fertitta with his analytics charts and said, we actually won.
Oh my God, I can't. Well, we lost Maxey.
Can you imagine if you were the owner of a team, or better yet, let's say the Sixers lose tomorrow. I don't know who they're playing next, but they lose a game and he comes out and he does sit at the table. And the first thing he says to the fans is, by the way, I know we lost the score, but we won statistically.
You know, it's really funny you say that because we've got about, 8 minutes left in the show. Dave Dombrowski and John Middleton spoke this week.
Look at you segueing right off. For some reason, you're not comfortable talking about Daryl Morey.
No, I'll talk Daryl Morey, but I think it's a really good contrast with. I mean, I'm not a Morey fan. I've never really been a Morey fan. I don't know what you want me to say about that. But Middleton in the interview said, I was talking to Dave about it. I hate this expression. I hate the expression of that's just baseball. Because it allows you to think what you want to think. Oh, we didn't do well? That's baseball. I'm 1-for-20? Well, that's baseball. So it's like the clear contrast between Morey.
I don't even know. What was the context of that?
It was a long-ranging interview. And this was a bunch of quotes about him talking about how they have to become more disciplined at the plate. Some of that is we have guys who just chase too much and they have to stop. They just have to become more disciplined. It's not enough to say, well, look, this is just the way that person is. That person has to change. Like that is,
I can't wait to have for him to have that conversation with Castellanos.
Well, that's the implication. I mean, he said he didn't name Turner, Castellanos and Real Muto, but he
as somebody who coached a little tiny bit of competitive baseball of kids. Okay, it's called muscle memory. And by the time you get to the major leagues, you can tweak things here or now, but you've now swung and seen baseballs tens of thousands of times. Your muscle memory, your brain memory reacts to something. You're not changing.
He called that out, though. We need to learn from the NLDS loss. I think some old dogs need to learn new tricks. I've seen people develop two-strike approaches at the plate. People can do it. People on this team have done that. Bryce Harper learned a whole different position, for God's sake. But everybody's got to do that.
No. Hold on. There is a difference between learning a new position, where, by the way, you don't have muscle memory. You're learning it when you learn a new position, and swinging a bat at a ball. Your brain, tens of thousands of times you've done this. You cannot, once you hit 30, all of a sudden change your game.
I just find it an interesting contrast with leadership in one organization not accepting it. Whether or not they make changes about it, I'm glad they're even talking about it.
I'm with you on there's a difference in ownership and taking accountability.
Yes.
Because
I'm
that
looking
theme
for
works
some
for me.
Sixers accountability here.
There's,
Like,
but there's,
it's
but there
really,
has not been any.
no, and it's really easy to blame Embiid, who shares a ton of the blame. But where the hell is the team? What are
They're
they
in
doing?
Washington. They're in Washington. They found a team that's doing better, so that's what they're focusing on. They leveraged their money from the Sixers in order to buy a better team. So now they got the Commanders. They're look, you're entitled to buy whatever you want with whatever money you want. But the fact is, find me lots of ownership groups that have teams in competing markets and care.
By the
Okay.
way,
That
the hearings are
and
getting.
that makes it worse is that we have a team that has no roots here.
Don't
They have
worry.
a hockey team that competes with the Flyers in their own bit in the same building.
Yes.
They have now a football team that is hated and is a competitor within the division of the team that plays across the street from the Sixers. What's the next move? Are they going to they can't buy the Mets because Cohen's not selling them. So what are they going to do? Like, are they going to buy the Braves next? Like, what's the point here? And so you're asking for accountability. You're not going to get it. You haven't gotten it for as long as this ownership group has been here. You can't name a time that there has been. But think of the drama that has happened with this organization from Hinkie to constantly picking players that were injured and would sit out, to the Ben Simmons drama, Jimmy Butler drama,
Markelle Fultz
James
drama.
Harden drama, Markelle Fultz drama, general manager drama with Colangelo.
Zaire Smith drama.
It never stops.
No.
When do you have, how many organizations do you know that are successful that have drama? There is a correlation between consistency, stability, accountability, and winning. Doesn't mean you win a championship every year, but go look at the Steelers. Do they have drama? And what they had drama with Antonio Brown, but other than that, drama? No. With the 49ers, drama? No. Kansas City Chiefs, drama? No. And you can go through Golden State Warriors, drama? No. Like, I can pick the teams that have been consistent in each league, and there is a consistency to ownership, accountability, way players treat people. It all goes through the organization, and it does start with the top. There is the saying, the buck stops here, and that's it's the same reason the Cowboys can be worth, as in your terms, a gazillion dollars and be a total cluster bleep
Yes, they are.
and not win. And see that I made you smile.
Yes. They're honestly such a cluster bleep that it's Eagles Dallas week, and I don't think people really care anymore. Like, there's Dallas isn't good.
Not
So
only is Dallas not good, it's there's no accountability.
now.
To the contrary, with the Cowboys, it's you have ownership that is also the general manager, so there is zero accountability.
That's a double
Yes,
disaster right
and
there.
the owner says stupid things week after week, and now they're going to start Cooper Rush when their very expensive quarterback had a serious injury, which, by the way, there were comments before his results came out about whether he was playing hard or whether it was real. It's a real injury, and he's now on the injured list. They have Trey Lance, who was, I believe, the number three pick in the draft a couple of years ago. Why would they not find out if what they traded for is worth something instead of bringing Cooper Rush in? Anybody think that the Cowboys are going anywhere with Cooper Rush?
No,
He's
and
not
look,
the
I
next
mean,
Tony. He's not the next Tony Romo. I can guarantee it.
if they put Dak on IL, they're not going anywhere. So I didn't understand the moves they made trading to get a wide receiver it just didn't really make much sense to me. The Eagles didn't make any moves, though. Not like their moves at the deadline have really done much in the past few years. So I can't necessarily fault them.
Well, wait. So your conclusion is because they made bad moves in the past, they should make no moves?
No, not at all. I would have preferred that they got a defensive end. Especially with, you know, Lattimore going to the Commanders, with the defensive end going to the Lions. You saw
Za'Darius Smith.
Yeah, Za'Darius Smith is who I would have liked to get here. Mm-hmm. So you have to hope that the guys you have here are able to advance and do more. They started the youngest secondary last week in the league. So you've got this kind of like split where on defense, they've got all this turnover with young guys, and on offense, they've got this really experienced offense going.
You know what would have been a sneaky good pick too is the Patriots traded Josh Uche for basically nothing.
Nothing.
And that would have been a sneaky good pick.
By the way, I only sent you one text message last week. I cannot let the show end with our 30 seconds left. Saquon, man.
Without sending me a heart emoji?
Saquon. Does that still hurt when you watch him jump over people backwards now? You ever seen anything like that?
He got hurt on that play. Anything like that? No, but that was my concern.
You saw him the minute he got hit on the back. I didn't like that.
That's how you get a bruised kidney or something worse. You do not want to expose your back the way he did. It was an amazing play, but the entire time I'm just grimacing going, ooh. But yeah. He's something special. I always knew he was. Giants should have never picked him as high as they did, and yet he's still something special.
That's going to be the last thought for this week. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.